Hello, this is Dr. David Friedman, host of To Your Good Health Radio. Today, we're diving into the fascinating and complex world of fish with America's leading nutritionist, Marion Nestle, renowned for her background contributions to modern food studies. She's here to share insights from her latest book, The Fish Counter. She'll reel in, pun intended there, all these facts out there about fish, how they're grown, marketed, labeled, and consumed across America. And we're going to explore the intricate journey fish take before reaching the supermarkets. And we're going to unpack the health benefits that they offer, tackle concerns like mercury and pollution levels. And plus, we're going to take a sneak peek into her upcoming book, What to Eat Now, The Indispensable Guide to Good Food, How to Find It, and Why It Matters. We got lots to cover today. Stay tuned. When it comes to food, we're joined by the definitive authority to guide us. And it all starts now.
It's To Your Good Health Radio with number one best-selling author and renowned wellness expert, Dr. David Friedman, changing lives just for the health of it.
Our next guest is a pioneering figure in nutrition, food studies, and public health. She's professor emerita at New York University, where she chaired the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health over a decade, and is currently a visiting professor at Cornell University. With a PhD in molecular biology and an MPH in public health nutrition, she's dedicated her career to examining how scientific, societal, and corporate forces shape food choices and their health impacts. She's been named among the top 10 in health and science by Time Magazine, Science Magazine, and The Guardian. She's the best-selling author of 16 influential books, including Food Politics, which really is considered the most influential health books ever written by many, including me. Her research has earned her numerous accolades, including the James Beard Leadership Award and Edinburgh Medal. Her latest book is called The Fish Counter. Welcome back to the show, Marion Nestle.
Oh, hi. Thanks for the nice introduction. It's good to be here.
Yeah, great to have you back with us. Let's dive right in. Another pun intended there. Let's talk about fish. Before we address the negative concerns, though, share with us the health benefits of having fish as part of our diet.
Well, fish are high in protein, which is the big issue these days, and low in saturated fats, which may or may not be an issue these days. And they're the best source of omega-3 fatty acids. And for that reason, they're really healthy or considered to be really healthy. But, oh, they raise so many issues that I considered in writing these chapters to the fish to be the wild west of the supermarket counters. I mean, you just have no idea what's going on there. And I approached writing this as a consumer. When I go to a fish counter and everything is in fillets laid out on ice, hopefully, I have no idea what any of that stuff is. I'm not an expert on fish. I can't tell one from another except for salmon, and really rely on fish sellers for a lot of the information that I feel like I need to make those kinds of choices.
Yeah. What really gets me is so many people avoid fish because of the mercury fear. But personally, I find it really odd, Marion, that the FDA downplays mercury in dental fillings and doesn't mention its presence in high fructose corn syrup, brown rice, or mushrooms. Fish gets all the negative attention. Share what we need to know about mercury in fish and how to balance the benefits of seafood with these concerns, if there are any.
Well, the fish that are high in mercury, actually it's a methylated form of mercury, have a lot more of it than any of those other foods you mentioned. So I wouldn't worry about the mercury in high fructose corn syrup at all. What happens is that volcanoes and coal-burning power plants spew things into the atmosphere that contain a lot of mercury. Mercury itself isn't particularly toxic. But when it gets into the ocean, it can be acted upon by various kinds of plankton and algae. And methylmercury is extremely toxic to the nervous system. And the most famous example of that occurred in Miramata in Japan, when there was a company that was dumping a lot of mercury into the water. And there are famous, really sad photographs of mothers holding their really disabled children who have been affected by mercury poisoning. It's best to avoid it if possible. You can't do anything about volcanoes, but you can do a lot about coal-burning power plants. But every political attempt to get coal-burning power plants to clean up their emissions has gotten stopped by that industry. And the EPA has kind of given up on that.
Right. I know research suggests that selenium may counteract the negative effects of mercury, and many of the fish people avoid due to mercury concerns contain high levels of selenium, similar to how like lecithin in egg yolks helps offset the cholesterol concerns. My question is, couldn't the selenium in fish reduce mercury's toxicity and maybe even protect the brain?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to understand that there are only a few fish that are affected by this. Most fish are really low in methylmercury and are not a problem. The only ones that are a problem are the ones that are predatory fish, because what happens is that the methylmercury gets into the fish muscle, and then bigger fish eat smaller fish, and even bigger fish eat those. And by the time it moves up the food chain to the few really enormous predatory fish that are high in methylmercury, there are really only a few of them. And the only one that most people need to worry about is albacore tuna, because so many people eat albacore tuna. It has about half the methylmercury in the other big predatory fish like shark and tilefish that most people don't eat anyway. And you know, if you don't eat a whole lot of albacore tuna, you're unlikely to be taking very much in. And the rest of the fish that aren't big predatory fish really have so little that nobody should be worried about it.
Right. I'm glad you said that, because people hear mercury and think the whole ocean is just toxic mercury laden, and it's not. Let's address a question I hear from patients on why they don't eat fish. I ask, big thing, pollution, polluted waters. But here's something I wonder: if polluted oceans are the reason people steer clear of fish, why do they still eat food grown on polluted land, like industrial waste, farm runoff, household chemicals? These contaminate our air and our soil. That impacts plants and animals that we eat. So why does ocean pollution get all the attention while the effects of land pollution on our food barely get even discussed?
Oh, I think the effects of land pollution get discussed a lot. Everybody's worried about PFAS and other organic chemicals right now.
They do, but they don't think twice about eating land. But boy, when it comes to fish, this, oh, pollution, pollution. It's for some reason we've got this vision that, yeah, you know, it's starting to get out about the pollution in the air and the soil, but people still eat it. But boy, they'll stay away from fish for some reason.
Well, the plants selectively uptake what they take. So plants are not loaded with these organic chemicals. Most of the organic chemicals get into the water, and that's a separate issue. I mean, again, a lot of this has to do with politics. And the politics of keeping the water supply clean seems to me to be something worth attention.
Yeah. Talk to us about the route that fish undergo before it reaches the market. You know, I go to these grocery stores and I see all this stuff from overseas, and it's like, that can't be fresh. Talk to us about what's going on there. And it's very rarely do I see stuff from America now in the grocery stores.
Well, the American fish, there are salmon in Alaska. That would be an American fish that you would get. And there are oysters and other kinds of shellfish that are certainly grown locally. But most of our fish comes from Asia, and it comes to us frozen. And there are some absolutely hilarious things about it, so that sometimes there are farmed fish here that are packed up and sent to Asia for packing and for cleaning up and packing. That seems kind of amazing, and then sent back to us. But if you're eating shrimp, the chances of it coming from the United States are very low. It mostly comes from Asia.
Right. I know Vietnam, China, Russia, I see so many of that. And I just wonder what safeguards are in place to ensure their quality and safety.
Well, not nearly the same ones that we have here. So that's a big concern. But, you know, if you want cheap shrimp, you're going to be getting it from Asia.
You talked a little bit about label inaccuracies. What should consumers look for when buying fish? Is there anything they could do, or just, you know, roll the dice and hope that it's what they say?
Well, mostly what's on labels is accurate. And the FDA has looked at that any number of times. And most companies have accurate labels, except for supplements. Supplements would be an exception. But for any kind of food, I think, you know, to a first approximation, what you see is what you're getting. It's just that fish are supposed to be labeled with their country of origin, So you're supposed to be able to know where the fish came from, although that's complicated because country of origin can mean the country of the shipping of the fishing vessel that picked it up. It doesn't necessarily mean the waters around that country. And it should say whether it's been dyed or it has anything artificial added. What I have found is that the best way to find out about fish is to ask your fish seller about it. And if you're lucky enough to a store that has a decent fish counter, you'll learn a lot from those people. They know a lot.
That's true. Talk about the bottom dwellers, which often get a bad rap because they feed on the ocean floor where pollution and mercury accumulate. But interestingly, while people avoid shrimp, lobster, clams, and oysters for that reason, they don't think twice about eating flounder, a fish that also lives and burrows at the bottom of the ocean. Can you help clarify the real risks and potential benefits of eating bottom-dwelling seafood?
Well, they're bottom dwellers and they're low on the food chain. What you want when you're eating fish is to eat fish and seafood that's as low on the food chain as possible, because the toxic substances accumulate as they go up the food chain. So the bigger fish are the ones that are most problematic. And one of the things that just broke my heart when I was doing this research was that there are hardly any waters in the United States in which sports fisher people are allowed to eat what they catch, because the water supplies in the United States are so poisoned by runoff from agricultural production or industrial pollution that the fish aren't safe to eat. I think that's terrible.
I know they call lobsters the cockroaches of the sea, but I'll tell you what, I love them. I don't care if they're called that. To me, that's a delicacy.
Well, again, they're filtering. Just like oysters and clams and other shellfish are filtering. And in general, they're okay to eat, except in the wrong season when they could be poisoned with some kind of virus.
That's true. And we can't talk about fish without bringing up the farm-raised. Share your views on wild-caught versus farm-raised fish and what consumers should be aware of. Is it a concern, as we hear about, with the farm-raised?
Well, it depends on what farm. You know, the oceans are enormously overfished. The industrial fishing techniques that are used don't give the fish a chance. I mean, they really don't have a chance. You're looking at schools of fish with radar, you're using drones, you're using explosives, you're using all kinds of things, nets that are literally miles long. The fish don't have a chance. So the oceans are enormously overfished. And so the solution to the big seafood problem is, how about farming it? And here again, some farms are better than others. And farmed fish is looked at with great disdain, in part because you got to feed those fish. And the question is, what are you going to feed them with? And so in most cases, they're fed the same thing as pets, the equivalent of dog food. They're fed pellets that have nutrients and various kinds of nutrients put in them. But there's usually an excess, and then the water is polluted. And if the water isn't changed frequently, it can be polluted and cause problems. The fish can get sick. I mean, anytime you have large numbers of animals put together in very, very close environment, you're going to have problems. Not all of those problems have been solved.
Yeah, that's so true. What about oysters, scallops, and clams? Are they healthy for us?
Oh, absolutely. And they're delicious, and they do wonders for the water in which they're grown, because they're cleaning up the ocean and cleaning up the pollution in the ocean and filtering it. And I'm really excited when I see all these oyster farms off the coast of the Northeast. I just hope that the water can stay at the right pH long enough to keep these farms going.
Yeah, see, it's so great that you embrace the oyster, scallops, and clams, but so many people say, oh, filter. They hear that word, they think, oh, that's new. They're filtering the junk. It's like a liver. It's got all the garbage and the disease, you know, chemicals. And no, it's not true. You know, that's one of the big reasons people don't go with clams, oysters, or scallops. And it's just unwarranted, correct?
Well, I don't know. Some people don't like the way they taste and don't like The idea of eating raw oysters doesn't appeal to me.
Yeah, me neither. I'm all for the steam, though. Let's switch gears and discuss your upcoming book, What to Eat Now, an ouch revised edition of one that you wrote about 20 years ago. How has the food landscape changed since the original edition?
Well, it's changed enormously. But before I get to that, I just want to say that the fish counter is the fish chapters reproduced from What to Eat Now as a separate little book in a series from Picador Press on oceans, rivers, and streams. It's one of a set of four books with absolutely gorgeous covers. I think the fish chapters work as a separate book, and it was brilliant of them to do it that way. But that's a separate book. What to Eat Now is a much, much larger book. It's going to be around 750 pages, and it's essentially an updated edition of the book that I wrote nearly 20 years ago. And it's longer because so much has changed since then. I was not paying very close attention, I have to confess. And I thought that revising the book would be a pretty short project. And instead, it turned out to be a 3-year research project. And the most obvious noticeable changes, I think, are in the drinks. I mean, it's the first thing you notice when you come into a supermarket. It used to be that it was always Coke and Pepsi, piled from floor to ceiling, and there would be a whole supermarket aisle, 100 to 120 feet long, with Coke on one side and Pepsi on the other. That's not true anymore. A lot of that has been replaced by water drinks of one kind or another. Fruit-flavored waters, enhanced waters, sometimes with alcohol or CBD, which is kind of amazing. And so I had to account for that in rewriting the book. And I have four chapters on waters, starting with what tap water is and then going on. And then there are new chapters on plant-based meats. Those are totally new. I've got a chapter on cannabis edibles. Those are certainly new. And I'm seeing cannabis drinks certainly in supermarkets. And, you know, a lot of it depends on what state you're in, but still. And the entire marketing of foods has changed in ways that really surprised me, so that the food product examples that I used in What to Eat when it came out in 2006, not a single one of those still exists. Those products have been completely replaced. And I hadn't realized how much the supermarket was turning over. You know, and then the international sections have gotten much, much larger. There's a much greater emphasis on international foods. The produce section has changed. Organics are everywhere. I could not find a single supermarket that was selling produce that did not have organic products. And that was certainly not true 20 years ago.
No. I think people are definitely getting more health conscious. I'm curious, there's so many popular food myths out there that have been debunked over the years. Probably in the 20 years you've seen, like, wow, that's no longer relevant. Eggs cause high cholesterol. That's been debunked. And drinking 2 glasses of wine every day is heart healthy. They say not anymore. And more recently, the plant-based meat alternatives are a healthier choice than real meat. And those aren't always as healthy as they project that they are. Is there any current belief that you think is a myth that needs to be put to rest once and for all?
Well, my favorite myth is that nutrition changes all the time. What you've just described are what I would call details, but the fundamental principles of nutrition have never changed. And they're so simple that the journalist Michael Pollan can do it in 7 words: eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And that really takes care of it. So we're able to put together healthy diets from an enormous range of foods available to us, and we can pick foods that we love, and as long as they're real food, not too heavily processed, what is now called the ultra-processed, contains some plants, so we get the fiber and nutrients that are in plants, and balance the calories so we don't gain weight inappropriately.
So true. You've been a leading voice in food study for decades. I'm curious, what's one thing you've learned about our food system that still surprises or maybe even frustrates you today? Is there any particular thing you can point out?
Oh, the marketing. Absolutely, the way foods are marketed, and particularly the way what junk or ultra-processed foods are marketed to children. That still troubles me a lot. And when I look through supermarkets at the foods that are marketed specifically to children, I don't find them particularly healthy.
And they place them lower there on the aisle so you kids can grab them. Mommy, mommy, I want this. And then they don't put them up on the top shelf. They want them eyeballs, the bright colors, the cartoons. And you're right, it's such a marketing thing for children. You know, I can still sing the jingles that I heard when I was a kid about all the, you know, the Pop-Tarts and the cereal when I was a kid. I still remember the jingles. So they really get in my head. I mean, it's 50 or 60 years later.
That's brilliant marketing in action.
It really is. You know, I hear people, a lot of times they say when they go to Europe, they can eat foods like bread, pasta, cheese, things that cause gut issues when they're here in the U.S. without any problems at all. What does American food seem to be so much harsher? Why is it so tougher on the bodies compared to what's available in Europe?
The way I like to put it is this. Food companies are not social service agencies, and they're not public health agencies. They're businesses with stockholders to please. Their single sole, most important purpose is to sell as much of what they're making as they possibly can at as high a price as they can get away with. This doesn't have anything to do with the health of the American public, but what it has done is fostering a system in which everybody is trying to find a food product that will be a winner. Remember, the description of a healthy diet is to eat food. That doesn't mean food products. It means food, things that are grown on trees, grown in the ground, or raised as animals. And to the extent that people have most of their diet on foods or minimally processed foods, it's easier for them to stay healthy. But the food products are deliberately designed, formulated, to be irresistibly delicious, if not addictive. And there are big arguments about whether these products are addictive, but they sure are hard to stop eating. And we have a lot of evidence for that now. So if you want to control your weight and don't want to be putting on a lot of pounds, you need to be avoiding what are called the ultra-processed foods, the really heavily processed ones, because for reasons that are still not explained, they encourage people to eat more.
Yeah, and it's so confusing. I mean, there's now 30,000 products that the average supermarket carries. That's a lot of noise to shuffle through and make your informed choices, as you said, because the marketing, you know, is there something they should just flip it over and just look at the label and say, nope, not that? Is there something where people can say, that's a no-no, Miriam said so, and then put it back on the shelf?
Well, it used to be that I could say, really what you should do is just walk the periphery of the supermarket and don't set foot in the center aisles, because the center aisles is where a lot of the junk food is. But supermarkets have caught on to that. And now those foods are even in the produce section. But, you know, if you can cook, it makes eating healthfully a lot easier. And if you have time to cook, and if you have the equipment to cook with, it makes staying healthy much, much easier.
Yeah. How important is shopping for organic for those that are struggling with their pocketbook? Is there certain things they should go with organic, or really try to get everything possible?
Well, I'm greatly in favor of organic. Organic is a production principle. There are rules about how foods are produced so that they end up with far fewer traces of pesticides, herbicides, and fertilizers in the blood of people who eat a lot of organic food. I think that's a good thing. And also, it's better for the soil, it's better for the environment, and it's better for health. But because it's harder to grow organic foods and to follow all those rules, they end up costing more. And that's really not fair. I mean, what we need is a federal subsidy system that supports healthier production of foods and discourages production of unhealthy foods. But that's the exact opposite of the way the system works now. So if you're somebody who doesn't have a lot of money and is trying to eat healthfully, it's still better to eat fruits and vegetables, even if they're not organic, than not to.
So true. You know what gets me is people buy organic, think it doesn't have the chemicals. But if you sit there in about 15 minutes, you're going to notice that water gets sprayed on these fruits and veggies. And guess where that comes from? Tap water, which is loaded with PFAS and chromium-6, BPA. So it's important to wash, correct? Don't assume that organic means there's nothing on the outside, correct?
Yeah, but the studies that look at the chemicals in the blood of people who eat largely organic foods and people who don't find far fewer among the people who are eating organic. So yes, there are chemicals and yes, there are difficulties with all of that. But if you can afford it, I think they're worth it.
So true. I know you spent so many decades exposing how politics and the industry shape our food choices. In your opinion, what's the single most powerful change, policy, consumer behavior, or otherwise, that really could transform the way America eats? What would you go in there and say, nope, this has got to go, that's got to stay, this has to go?
Well, most efforts are aimed at individuals on the theory that personal choice is what counts, and it certainly does. But personal choice backed up by policy is really the most effective way to make changes. You know, and price is an enormous consideration in what people buy for obvious reasons, particularly now that prices are up so high. And we have a subsidy system that subsidizes the cost of junk foods in many, many ways. I mean, for example, companies can deduct the cost of marketing as business expenses. That's taxpayer subsidy. We don't charge food companies for what are called the externalized costs of what they produce. That is the cost to human health and the cost to cleaning up the environment. Taxpayers pay that. And there are ways in which we could change that system to promote a much healthier food production and much healthier environment. But those are political choices.
Yeah, so true. Well said. In the 2 minutes we have left, is there anything you'd like to share with the listeners we did not get to cover today?
Oh, enjoy your food. Food is one of life's greatest pleasures. And, you know, there's so many different ways to eat healthfully and eat sustainably that are still absolutely delicious and will make your family and your kids happy. And I just think food is a wonderful part of human life. And I never want to do anything to discourage people from enjoying their food.
The ultimate foodie right there. I love it. I love it. It's been a pleasure having you back on the show. I wish you continued success in all your endeavors, and I commend you for your unwavering passion for helping us eat better and achieve optimal health. You're welcome back anytime.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
You can get your copy of Fish Counter and pre-order What to Eat Now, the revised edition, by visiting foodpolitics.com. And while there, be sure and check out the many resources of information available from audios, videos, interviews, and health articles. I'm on her email list. I get Miriam's little tidbits right to my inbox. So sign up, get those. Very informative. You can follow her on Instagram and X at Marion Nessel. You can follow me on Facebook and X at Dr. David Friedman. On Instagram, I'm at Dr. D. Friedman. If you heard something today that was shared that, you know, somebody you know needs to hear, send them a link to this podcast available at toyourgoodhealthradio.com and peruse our podcast library. Share these segments of interest with friends, family, coworkers, and on social media. As I always say, don't be selfish. Sharing is caring. Don't keep this info to yourself. And you can also subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. More to come. Stay tuned and stay well.